You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko kēsta tōku ingoa. No mai haere mai ki Te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host, Caster, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Thomas. E whaakēnei coming up on the show for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party Simon Court, asked about the government's recent bill seeking to define man and woman in law. Tuesday Wire host Alex spoke to President of the Post-Primary Teachers Association, Chris Abercrombie, about the NCEA changes and how they could affect schools. And I spoke to Green Party co-leader and MP for Auckland Central, Chloe Swarbrick, about a proposal to remove the post office from Lamb's Pharmacy on Karangahape Road. Thomas, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to Forest and Bird Acting General Counsel, May Downing, about a challenge against the Tukituki Water Storage Project consent extension. And I also talked to Honorary Academic in Physics from the University of Auckland, Kevin Trenberth, about funding cuts to the Global Ocean Observing System.
He aha o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, wai mai rane, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kaua e wareware, e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei pakere rokiroki mārunga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more as always by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
Last week, NZ First MP Jenny Marcroft put forward a bill that would seek to define the terms man and woman in New Zealand law. The bill has been supported by coalition parties through its first reading. Its primary supporters in Parliament, ACT and New Zealand First, say the bill is about prioritising biology over ideology and about maintaining common sense. Its opponents, however, say the bill is unnecessary and the ideology pushed by its supporters does not align with evidence. Te Kahui Tika Tangata, the Human Rights Commission, says that the bill is not necessary and risks harm to communities who continue to experience discrimination on the basis of their gender identity. Disability Rights Commissioner and Rainbow Rights spokesperson at the Human Rights Commission, Prudence Walker, says the bill will not only trample on the mana of trans and intersex people, but it also attempts to completely erase non-binary people. Despite the strong opposition, the government is pushing for the bill to be considered in select committee. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, Simon Court, I asked about the bill and why the government is bringing it up. Disclaimer, this interview covers multiple anti-trans talking points and briefly discusses sexual violence. The bill is set to define woman and man in law. It passed its first reading last week. My first question about this bill is why? Why is it coming about now? Why is the ACT Party supporting it?
Well, sometimes laws matter because of what they permit or what they prohibit. And sometimes laws matter because of what they clarify. And Jenny Marcroft's bill is that kind of law. It won't solve every debate, but it pushes back on the idea that people have to pretend biological sex is unknowable or irrelevant. The bill won't materially change people's day-to-day lives if it passes in its current form, and it doesn't just stop anyone describing themselves or choosing to identify themselves however they like. All it does is give the law a clear default meaning for words like man and woman, male and female. So it is intended to clarify where some people feel there is confusion.
I guess I want to expand on that a bit further because you didn't really get into the reason for that clarification. Is what the current law sets out inadequate in terms of what you'd like to see in terms of definition? And if so, what are those inadequacies and how will this bill address them?
Well, there's just some fundamental problems in that women who are a protected, who have protections in law because of their innate vulnerabilities, so protected spaces, you know, such as bathrooms and so on, these protections have been diluted by SIDS that if anybody can call themselves a woman, then they can enter these spaces. And there, you know, women genuinely feel that they should have that protection. So that is one of the reasons why I understand Jenny Marcroft has proposed this members bill. And you got to remember, it's not a government bill. It's proposed by a member, and the three governing parties have supported it to Select Committee for review. So the Select Committee will work out whether the problem definition is correct or not. But there's some real challenges facing, you know, people who work in areas like midwifery, where, you know, they've been told that actually if you're dealing with a woman who is having a baby, you need to talk to her about chest feeding, and that she's not a pregnant woman, she's a pregnant person or a person with a cervix. Now, these are all incredibly dehumanising and frankly irrational ways to describe women who are pregnant and going to have a baby. And so this kind of stuff has become like almost impossible to navigate through without clarification from government. And so for all of those people who still know that breastfeeding involves a mum and a baby and a breast, we're going to restore their ability to have that conversation without feeling like they're going to be subject to the language police in their organisation.
Yeah, Simon, I want to contest against that a little bit. First of all, I have two questions.
Which
about...
Which bit? Breastfeeding between a mum and a baby?
No, I have two questions about your comments that this is something that's happening regularly, that this language is something that's being used all the time. I guess people still call it breastfeeding. People still say pregnant women all the time. These are very common terms. And not only are these very common terms, this bill doesn't say anything about the use of those terms. So what I'm trying to understand is, do you think that these terms are being used so commonly that legislation is necessary to address that? And secondly, this legislation doesn't address that. So what do you think is going on there?
Well, what it's going to enable, and of course we have to let it go through Select Committee, but what I've described to you is some of the concerns that people have genuinely raised. And, you know, when I look at the New Zealand College of Midwives information, they say that many midwives in Aotearoa, New Zealand, have adopted inclusive terminology such as chest feeding and refer to pregnant people or parents. Now, that is not cool for a whole lot of new mums who are trying to get to grips with all the challenges of getting a baby to feed and who've experienced labour and childbirth, and to have to navigate through this essentially woke language is not helpful at a time when they actually need proper support. So, look, the bill is going to clarify what is a man, what is a woman, what is male and what is female. And, you know, for people of my generation, I mean, I was born in the 70s, I'm Gen X, like, never imagined that, you know, Parliament would have to do this. I never could imagine in my life until I heard these terms used very recently that this would even be a matter of discussion. It sounds quite irrational and frankly unhinged to many of us of an earlier generation. And I think that, you know, for the benefit of most New Zealanders, if the law can clarify these matters, what is a woman and what is a man, as unnecessary as it might sound to some, that's going to be much more helpful going forward.
You're saying it sounds unnecessary to some. One of those some seems to be the Minister for Women, National MP Nicola Grigg, who, when the bill was going through its first reading, said that there were numerous concerns over the bill. And then I'm going to quote her here. She is not convinced that this bill would advance the rights of women and girls in any way, shape or form. That's pretty strong criticism from within the government and from our Minister of Women, no less. How would you respond to that, especially given that that's coming not from the other side, not from the opposition, from someone who has supported this bill, saying that she's not convinced it will give any advancement to rights of women and girls in Aotearoa?
Well, her party, National voted for the bill and they voted to send it to Select Committee. So I'm sure that many of the concerns that Minister Gregg raised in her speech will be addressed there.
Do you think it will advance the rights of women and girls?
Well, as I mentioned in my opening remarks, there are many people, including organisations or groups that stand up for women and girls' rights that are adamant that defining what is a man and what is a woman and then being able to use those definitions to reinforce safe spaces for women, such as changing rooms, such as bathrooms, where women are incredibly vulnerable to the risk of having men come into those spaces who are much physically stronger and who shouldn't be in those spaces. And that's because men are able to identify as a woman. And so for the purpose of creating or of essentially reinforcing the ability of women to exclude men from places that they are uniquely vulnerable from, then it will help.
I want to contest that a bit, Simon. 99% of sexual violence in Aotearoa is perpetrated by cisgender men. If we're proposing this law to address violence perpetrated by some of our trans whānau, supposing that that's something that we need to deal with, should we also be passing legislation to restrict cis men who seem to be doing a quite disproportionate amount of sexual violence in this country?
Well, I mean, I don't really understand what you mean by cis men, but as far as I'm aware, if women feel afraid because men, no matter what they might be wearing or how they identify, can come into their changing rooms and come into their bathrooms, then they deserve to have the protection of the law, and the government needs to recognise that their unique vulnerability because of their innate sex characteristics, being women, being physically smaller, having less muscle mass, and having this unique and important role in our civilization to carry children and to be mums, then the government should protect them in the places where they are vulnerable.
There's been a question raised over this law and how it will affect our current abortion legislation, which clarifies that women can get abortions in Aotearoa. As the bill currently stands, it would prevent people under the age of 18 from getting abortions in Aotearoa. Is that a concern for the ACT Party?
Look, the ACT Party has referred this bill to Select Committee, so all of those issues can be teased out down the track. Once the Select Committee's had a chance to hear evidence, no doubt, like most bills that are referred to a Select Committee, a committee can recommend changes and a government can act on those changes. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of the Select Committee on that matter.
There's also concerns being raised over how this bill will affect some of our intersex New Zealanders who don't clearly fit into either category. Is that a consideration that the government's been looking at all?
Well, people should be free to live with dignity and without harassment, no matter how they choose to live their lives. That's a core ACT value. But compassion for one group cannot mean removing language, privacy, fairness or protection from others. So, I understand that some people feel concerned about the way that this bill is going to clarify, what the law says is male, female, man, woman. The law also upholds people's basic human rights. That's what the Bill of Rights Act is there to do. And New Zealand has very strong human rights legislation that protects people from things like harassment, whether they're in the workplace or in public.
I mean, there's a very clear situation, though, where these people do not fit in either category, and the future is uncertain, right, for this group of people who, through no fault of their own, right, through the way they were born, do not fit into either category laid out by this law. What will happen for this group of people?
Well, I'm sure that the Select Committee will consider that in due course. We will see their findings. But, of course, what you're talking about is a very small group of people.
As common as redheads, Simon.
I mean, you contend that now on the radio. I haven't seen that. I haven't seen that.
You can look it up right now. You can Google it. They're as common as redheads.
Well, it's wonderful to be encouraged to do my own research during a radio interview. But look, that's what the select committee process is for. And you know, when there are groups that laws have or proposed bills have failed to take account of people's needs, they can come to the select committee. They can present evidence, and I'm sure the Parliament Select Committee will take that into account.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court speaking to me about the government's recent bill to clarify the terms man and woman in New Zealand law.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
Their preferred habitat is just not being eaten alive.
The Wire.
New Zealand Post recently announced plans to take away the postal service in Lamb's Pharmacy on Karangahape Road after 30 years of service. Residents and business owners on Karangahape Road have protested against the announcement, with posters raising awareness and a petition that the owner of Lamb's Pharmacy is set to pass on to Auckland Central MP Chloe Swarbrick today. The event is set to run till 12:30, with Swarbrick set to table the petition in Parliament tomorrow. I began this interview by asking about what the rationale is from NZ Post getting rid of the office at Lamb's Pharmacy.
So this is something which we've seen over the last 2 years with the direction from this government, particularly the state-owned enterprises minister Simeon Brown giving the directive for New Zealand Post to start cutting costs effectively, where we've seen the slow whittling away of community services. So last year we were dealing with the closure of the post office in Three Lamps. There's been a number of closures on Waiheke Island, which is also part of my constituency in Auckland Central. And now the kind of lightning rod, which is the proposed closure of the postal services at Lamb's Pharmacy on Karangahape Road. People may know that it's been operating for a number of decades now and is obviously an accessible and well-loved postal service by the community, which also helps, of course, to keep business going for a small community family-owned pharmacy in the middle of some incredibly hard times. The rationale that New Zealand Post have provided is that effectively they think that foot traffic is too low. We've come back with the point that we're about to experience the opening of the most expensive infrastructural project in the form of the City Rail Link, which we're all anticipating. We have a massive uplift in foot traffic around the Karangahape area, and also the fact that it's apparently about saving costs. But every time that I have tried to get any form of detail as to what apparent costs or harm there is for retention of these services, especially in a smaller amount of these services, while we wait for the CRL to open, they have been unwilling to engage with us. So I took it all the way to the top and wrote a letter to the Prime Minister about a month or two ago. True to form, we didn't get a response, nor did we from the Minister of State-Owned Enterprises office. But ultimately, the buck stops with the government, who are making this decision to have New Zealand Post cut its services, which is going to be of massive detriment to our communities across the country.
Yeah, you mentioned accessibility. That's an important issue around having a local post office, obviously, especially because a lot of the people living in the city aren't necessarily driving every day. They might be walking to and from their workplace, to and from the places where they're shopping and doing their post as well. Where is the next closest alternative if this goes?
So it's on Simon Street, and of course you'll note that is obviously not anywhere near as, and no shade whatsoever on those who are currently running those postal services, but it doesn't have that same kind of icon status, right? It's not a place that is well known and loved and frequented as Lamb's Pharmacy is. And to this effect, I'd actually just like to highlight that while, of course, it's the community who cares a lot about this, you only need to walk down Kay Road to see the signs and local businesses' windows supporting the retention of these local post office services. But it's actually also a number of the hotels that are in the surrounding area, some of which have also written letters in support. So we've got a number of the local businesses. We've got obviously the local community. We have some of the large businesses that service the tourists who are coming into the city. You've also got the local Member of Parliament in the form of myself and Mike Lee, the local councillor, as well as many from Waitematā Local Board, all saying that it makes sense both rationally, but also obviously from a community pride perspective to retain these post office services. And then you've got New Zealand Post basically just saying computer says no, the foot traffic counter is currently too low, without taking into account the fact that demonstrably that foot traffic counter is going to go up massively with the opening of the City Rail Link. It just doesn't make sense.
And lastly, I'd like to ask about that community element. We've seen a lot of Kay Road businesses struggling in some of the recent years. We've seen also the announcement that the Others Way Festival isn't going to continue this year. We've seen some struggles, particularly on Kay Road, for businesses. How important is it for the community to rally around and to fight for these sort of things going forward?
I think it's important to acknowledge that change is always inevitable. Of course, we're going to be confronted with circumstances that are outside of our control. But when it comes to the City Rail Link, what has always perplexed me is that we knew that disruption was going to be inevitable, and we could have done a lot better job planning for that disruption. And this is the point that I've made time and again since I became the local MP about 5 or so years ago, when we were already a few years into that construction. At that point in time, I managed to work with our council and with some of our local business associations to get the establishment of the hardship fund up and running. So businesses, small businesses in particular, who were being, you know, crunched from both sides, both with less foot traffic but also with increasingly high commercial rents, that they were able to get access to a form of support to stay alive. And now we've got these businesses that have hung on by their fingernails, who have been supported by a community who desperately cares about and loves them, who feel central to the identity in the fabric of our central city community, who potentially are going to fall over at the last hurdle. We can't take this lying down. We can't let this just happen to us, especially if the consequence of it might be the end of some of these family-owned community local businesses, only to be replaced by massive commercial conglomerates. That is not what we've all been fighting for, as we've been looking to have a more connected city with efficient public transport. And just the final point on the Others Way, well, of course, that was utterly devastating news. I've been working behind the scenes, and I hope that we will be able to have some form of phoenix rise from the ashes. But the major point that hopefully everybody listening takes away is that we can't just let these things happen to us. Politics and our country and our city belongs to the people who turn up and get involved and engaged. And I think the last thing that any of us, particularly our broader music and Auckland Central community, would want is for Auckland truly to just become a bland concrete playground. We deserve so much better than that.
That was Auckland Central MP and Green Party co-leader Chloe Swarbrick speaking to me about plans to remove the postal service from Lamb's Pharmacy on Karangahape Road. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Experience the musical fusion of Saul Williams and Carlos Nino at the Tuning Fork this June.
If ever there were currents uncurrent, the wind cannot...
If you have a B card, you can be going for free. That's right, we have tickets to give away on Morning Glory. So grab that card of glory and listen out all week for your cue to enter.
Saul Williams meets Carlos Nino live at the Tuning Fork Tuesday, June 9th. Get your tickets now from tuningfork.co.nz.
Audio. Culture.
Tune in to 95BFM Drive every second Tuesday as they're joined by one of our friends from Audio Culture, sharing the songs, stories and salacious scandal from which is woven the mighty tapestry of New Zealand music.
Audio Culture, more cultured than a blue cheese with a BA. Every other Tuesday on 95BFM Drive.
Thanks to Audio Culture. Iwi Waiata, the noisy library of New Zealand music. Go to audioculture.co.nz.
Hey, Captain, do you think we'll ever find the land of the good groove?
Patience, Sonny Jim.
It's just, we've been floating on this dinghy for months. Months? Since the crew mutiny.
Patience, Sonny Jim.
It's concerning that you keep repeating that.
Repeating that?
I don't even think my name is Sonny Jim.
My name is Sonny Jim.
Is that my name? Captain?
Patience, Captain. Sonny Jim.
I am Sonny Jim. We are both Sonny Jim. Lando, we made it. Let's drink some more seawater to celebrate.
Land of the Good Groove with Murray Kamek. Bringing a solid hour of funk, electricity and soul to your Friday afternoons. Land of the Good Groove, 1 till 2 p.m. every Friday, right here on 95 BFM.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. That was You Freak Me by Supergroove.
You know, cracking open a beer, having a glass of wine while they're driving, while they're on the train and catching up with their mates. Like, it's just a really classy way to get around.
The Wire.
Last week, environmental organisation Forest and Bird filed judicial review proceedings in the High Court to challenge extension of consents for the Tukituki Water Storage Project. The consents, which were granted in 2015, were meant to expire after 10 years. But despite no physical work being done, the Hawke's Bay Regional Council, Central Hawke's Bay District Council, and Hastings District Council have decided to extend the lapse dates by an additional 5 years. Forrest and Bird have argued the environmental context of the project has changed in the last decade and wants to ensure decision makers go through the correct process. The organisation has a history of opposing the project, winning a Supreme Court case in 2017, stopping a land swap which would have allowed the dam to flood 22 hectares of public conservation land. To discuss the challenge against the Tuki Tuki Water Storage Project consent extension, I talked to Forest and Bird Acting General Counsel, May Downing. Now, can you first give us a bit of context on this Tuki Tuki Water Storage Project and why it's relevant again after 10 years?
Yes, absolutely. So about 10 years ago, consents for this large dam of the Makarorō River in the Ruahine Ranges was granted by a board of inquiry. Around that same time, as part of their application, they needed a land exchange with the Department of Conservation so that they could inundate part of the Ruahine Forest Park. But Forest and Bird took decided to grant that. We took it to the Supreme Court and won in around 2017. Now, that prevented those resource consents from ever being exercised because that land exchange was basically deemed unlawful. And fast forward now, last year, about a week before the consents were due to expire, they applied to the councils to get an extension of the lapse date, which they only granted a few months ago.
And Forest and Bird have talked about kind of the environmental context of the area and project changing. What kind of environmental impacts could this project have if it went forward?
The main ones of concern for Forest and Bird are the freshwater and terrestrial values. There will also be the lost recreational values, but that's not really within our warehouse to talk to. So the key freshwater issues are the loss of Oxbow wetland. So it's actually quite a haven of biodiversity values. It also includes not just these wetlands within the area that would be inundated, but braided river form, which is quite rare internationally. It also helps with the connectivity, providing habitat for indigenous freshwater fish. A lot of these are threatened or at risk. And in terms of terrestrial, they've found remnant lizard and bird populations, long-tailed bat, as well as other rare types of vegetation in the area. And just if I could add to that, this isn't just a dam for hydro and therefore contributing to renewable energy sources. This is actually to help with irrigation, and it's a catchment that's already suffering from poor water quality with high nitrogen levels, and this is just going to exacerbate it.
And did the council consult much with the local community and iwi when they made this decision to extend the consents?
So part of the requirements or the criteria that need to be considered with lapse extension. So there's three criteria, and one of them is approval from affected or interested parties. The legislative wording is persons who may be adversely affected by the granting of an extension. And I think they, with respect, cherry-picked the groups that they did want to consult with. So Forest and Bird wasn't consulted. I understand that DOC wasn't properly consulted. And it's only until after they made the decision we've had some mana whenua groups speak to us about not having been consulted.
And how important is it to hold decision makers to account with these types of projects?
Oh, we think it's absolutely critical, and that's why we've filed the claim.
And can it kind of feel difficult to challenge and resist when the government seems quite pro this project? They've got their fast track approval bill, which seems to be encouraging it, and they've also given $18 million funding loan to the project. Does that make it harder to feel like you're fighting against a bigger force?
Yes, to be honest though, it's feeling a lot like that with other cases we've got on the go, but when there's a matter of principle to defend, we stick to our guns on these things.
Is there anything else you'd like to say?
I forgot to mention, because they are quite a special bird, but they've also found, when you did ask about the ecological values, I omitted to refer to the blue duck or the seal, and they would be affected if this was to proceed.
That was Forest and Bird Acting General Counsel May Downing speaking to me about the challenge against the Tuki Tuki Water Storage Project consent extension.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
A new paper on the Global Ocean Observing System and how funding cuts may affect the quality of data it collects was released last week. The paper found that if the United States was to leave the system entirely, errors in data for how fast the ocean is warming could increase up to 163%. The scientists behind the paper are warning that if the funding goes ahead, it could undermine efforts to track warming and hurricanes and forecast weather, which is increasingly important as climate change impacts become worse. To discuss the funding of the Global Ocean Observing System, I talked to honorary academic in physics from the University of Auckland, Kevin Trenberth. Now, can you just start off by explaining the Global Ocean Observing System and why it's so important?
Yes, so the Global Ocean Observing System is run out of UNICEF, which is a bit of a problem in itself because some countries don't like to fund UNICEF, including the US, but the so-called GOOS has been reasonably funded. And the efforts really grew up in the 1980s. I was a part of that, in particular because of the El Nino phenomenon. And there's a major El Nino brewing at the moment. And so this meant trying to find out just what was happening a lot better in the tropical Pacific. And it ended up with an array of moored buoys. These are moored to the bottom of the ocean. Some of these cables were, 4 kilometers long. And there's an interesting little story that, the first time they put a couple out, the cable themselves was so heavy, it dragged the surface buoy down to the bottom and they sank. So they had to redesign the cable. But anyway, there's been some 100 or so of those out there for some time now. Most of them came from the U.S. initially, but Japan contributed, and now there's extra moorings in the Atlantic and in the Indian Ocean. And they are now complemented all by what are called Argo profiling floats. And these are long tubes. They're about a meter and a half long. They have a chamber inside that can either be pumped full of seawater, and in which case the float sinks. They normally reside about 1 kilometer depth, and then if you fill the chamber up, they sink to about 2 kilometers depth, and then they pump the seawater out, and as a result, the float sort of pops up to the surface, and on the way, it takes measurements of temperature and salinity, and then when it's on the surface, there's an aerial which radios all of that information back to ground-based stations. And these things drift with the current at about 1 kilometer depth, and then they trigger this profiling. And they do that about every 10 days. And there's about 4,000 of these around all of the global oceans now. Now, there's some places where they don't work very well, such as in coastal areas. They may run ashore or with ice, and so other means of measuring those regions have to be included. And there's some innovative ways of measuring under ice by putting a little instrument on the top of an elephant seal. And when they dive down and go under the ice, they make measurements of temperature and salinity. And when they come back up again, they radio that information back to the ground-based stations. It's amazing to see. If anyone's interested, you could Google elephant seals with instruments, and it's really spectacular. And so these are all run by a network of stations around the world. About half of the observations have been made by the United States, which has sort of led the development of this observing system. And there are other countries that purchase these Argo floats and participate by adding moorings in various places. And New Zealand plays a key role by helping to deploy these floats into places where gaps begin to occur. And so the goal is to have one of these floats about every 300 kilometers across the ocean, and that's done reasonably well. But of course, they're drifting. And some of them run ashore, some of them get fouled in various ways. That has been a problem that has had to be dealt with. They get fouled with salt and seaweed, and shells and so on grow on them.
And so they have a lifetime of about 4.5 to maybe 5 years now before the battery expires, and then they have to keep seeding them with new ones. And New Zealand's played a key role in doing that, although New Zealand has not purchased as many as some other countries. And now there are proposed cuts to both NOAA and the National Science Foundation in the United States under the Congress, and the U.S. contributions are threatened. And so what we did in our paper that has just been published in Nature Climate Change is to explore what happens if various kinds of cuts occur in this observing system, and how well would be able to measure various kinds of signals, and especially things like the global warming in the ocean.
And the paper found there'd be a drop-off in the quality of data if these cuts went through. What are the effects we'd see from this?
So if the U.S. were withdrawn from GOES entirely, then there would be reasonable monitoring in parts of the North Atlantic and regionally off of Australia and Japan and so on. But the estimate is that the estimates of how fast the ocean is warming, would the errors would increase by 163%. In other words, the information then is pretty useless in terms of tracking where all of the heat from global warming is going, because over 90% of it ends up in the ocean. And so that's a big issue. And of course, it depends exactly the nature of those cuts. And in the past, during the pandemic, there were big losses in some of the moored arrays in the tropical Pacific, moored buoys, because they have to be serviced sometimes every 6 months, but certainly every year in various ways. So there has to be a ship go out to do that. And so a lot of those were lost. And then the ability to track just what's going on with El Nino is greatly cut. And so with a big El Nino brewing at the moment, this turns out to be very important. And also in general with global warming, because the global warming not only affects the ocean and the expansion of the ocean, but it changes sea level. And so sea level is an important issue for New Zealand. And it keeps increasing on average globally, nowadays about 4 millimeters per year. And that adds up over time, and it means that storm surges and so on are greater than they used to be, and it causes flooding and erosion.
If this data is so important, especially now, why do you think there's been a decrease in funding for these important systems?
The funding grew up initially under research banners. That was true in the U.S., and over time, and so that would be under the National Science Foundation, for instance, maybe a little bit in NOAA, but there were major efforts made to at least get some of those become part of the routine funding for monitoring in those organizations. And this is true in other countries as well. And so in Europe, there's, I don't know exactly what the fraction is, let's say half or something like that is in the monitoring budgets of the organizations of the government. But the rest is in research grants, which means individual scientists have to write a proposal to get the instruments that they can then go out and deploy. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of the deployments of the floats are regional rather than global. And it's mainly the U.S. that has filled up the gaps globally. And Australia's done a fairly good job. And as I say, New Zealand helps to fill in the gaps. They deploy these floats from the United States and from other countries just using their oceanographic going ships. So New Zealand has played an important role. But the funding is often not secure. It's not part of an essential monitoring. And some people, unfortunately, in the Trump administration, for instance, don't want to know what's going on. And it's not just the ocean monitoring that is targeted, but also things like the very important Mauna Loa on in Hawaii, measurements of carbon dioxide, which is the longest carbon dioxide measurements. And, you know, carbon dioxide is going up at record rates, and that's one of the key things that signals that the planet, the atmosphere is changing and the planet is warming up and climate change is underway. And so some people don't want to know that. They'd rather fly blind, which is absolutely crazy to me.
That was honorary academic in physics from the University of Auckland, Kevin Tramberth, speaking to me about the defunding of the Global Ocean Observing System.
We'll be right back after the short break. This is Silent Lean by Tara Clerk and Trio.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. That was Mandarin Tree by Phoebe Rings.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
Earlier this month, Education Minister Erica Stanford announced details on the scheme replacing NCEA. The replacement, the New Zealand Certificate of Education, is aimed, according to the government, at tackling the confusion of the current system. This will be the most recent of the government's changes to the education system, which have frequently been the target of criticism from teachers and education unions. Tuesday Wire host Alex spoke with President of the Post-Primary Teachers Association, Chris Abercrombie, about the replacement and what it means for students and their teachers.
Awesome. Just to get us started, quarter much of the discussion around NCEA is the idea that it wasn't up to scratch. What are the issues that we're trying to target here with NCEA?
So I think it's really important to note that NCEA has been around for 20 years, so we've had almost a generation of New Zealanders go through it, and they're at every part of our society and have had success in many different ways. But there was some issues that had been identified, such as coherence and the maybe too much flexibility, because there was students who were leaving with a qualification that didn't actually set them up for future study or future work. So it was definitely some coherence and some flexibility issues that need to be dealt with. But we already had identified them, and actually we're already on a plan to fix those before this minister was even elected. So there wasn't anything new for us to sort out, if that makes sense.
And so when we look at kind of the fact that these issues are identified, what sort of changes did we already know needed to be made?
So we're looking at tightening up some of the flexibility. We're looking at fewer standards, but worth more credits to try and get a more consistent approach to assessment, and a bit more consistency between subjects. I'm a history teacher myself, so there was only 5 standards we could do. Other subjects had more standards that were less value, and so I was trying to get a bit more consistency between those, and so we were already well onto that plan, as I say, even before this minister was elected.
And so when we look at this, the replacement that has finally been kind of, well, with details announced for what is coming in to replace NCEA, on the surface, is there something there in terms of quality?
This feels like a significant overcorrection to the issues that have been identified. So this is going to create a whole heap of new issues. Basically, it's removing all flexibility. It's removing. It's making it far too consistent in this space. And so it's a significant overcorrection in a response to the flexibility. So this system is going to be too rigid, too inflexible, and is actually going to let students down.
And does this inflexibility kind of reflect how the government has approached NCEA and the education curriculum through their term?
Absolutely. This minister, for some reason, seems to think our young people are just vessels to be filled. You just pop their head open and pour the knowledge in, and then later on they'll regurgitate it in an exam, and that's the best way for them to learn and then to show that knowledge. It's just not the reality. Young people are amazing and complex and different, and they've got many different things going on in their life. They don't all start school at the same level. They don't all finish school at the same level. And so it's understanding that our young people are individuals and they're different, and creating a system that supports them to be the best they can be. And these changes aren't going to do that.
And I mean, on that, if we look at these changes coming in and the impact that they're going to have on young people, what can we expect to kind of see in terms of their learning outcomes under this new replacement system?
So in the Ministry of Education's own documentation, they say that Māori, Pacifica and low socioeconomic students and students from low socioeconomic backgrounds will achieve less under this new system. So even the government itself is admitting that this new system will disadvantage some people, and they're okay with that. They're fine with that. And I'm not. I'm not okay with that. We need a system where our young people can thrive, not one that we know will give them disadvantage. And so it's a real concern that this government openly admits that more young people will fail under this system.
And I mean, looking to the kind of What has already turned out to be a tumultuous period with new curriculums and a lot of consultation around what's going on with education, what can we expect to see with a new replacement curriculum in terms of adding to that chaos and instability?
Oh, it just creates significant issues for teachers and for schools and principals of managing this change, significant change, ongoing change, sometimes change within the change. Sometimes, as a teacher said to me recently, we're spending more time trying to figure out what the changes are than actually dealing with the changes. You know, with inconsistent communication coming from the ministry and the minister, it's all got different stuff. They're all saying different things. So it's very hard for teachers and schools to actually create consistency and create stability, because that's what our young people need and that's what they deserve.
And you've kind of mentioned it there, but when it comes to teachers and being able to handle this new change, what will this replacement kind of do for teachers and the workload that's already placed on them?
Well, and definitely in the short to immediate term, it's going to be a significant increase in workload as we have to adjust to all the new changes. And if there's a change of government, we might have more changes to adjust to. One of the number one thing teachers tell me when I visit them, I visit schools all the time, I talk to teachers nearly every day, is they are sick of the pillars of post political change that our education system has become. It never used to be like this. This is only a reasonably recent phenomenon. I've been teaching 20 years now, and it's probably only in the last 10 years we've seen this real chop and change every time there's a new government. And that's not what we need. We need consistency, and we need stability, and we need well-thought-out change, and we're getting none of those with this government.
And I mean, on those, on the kind of well-thought-out change and stability, what do you kind of want to see in this space then, whether or not it's from this government or a following government, on kind of trying to set out some stable groundworks for our schooling system?
Yeah, so we really want a real political consensus on education here in Aotearoa New Zealand, what the goals are, what the purpose of education is. But, you know, governments are going to govern. That's what they do. But what we expect is a clear roadmap, a well-resourced implementation plan, and key aspects of it, fully resourced, fully supported, so we can support teachers and teachers can support students to be the best they can be.
Looking at the plan as it stands now, that the government have released the details of, what in particular is actually just missing from this plan? What needs to come soon?
What needs to come soon is how this is going to be implemented. You know, at the moment it's all still rather big picture stuff. We're still lacking a bit of detail. Some of it's just window dressing, like if it's going to be an A, B, C or D or an excellence merit achieved. In the long run, that doesn't actually really matter. It's the nuts and bolts. It's the how is this going to work in schools? What is a teacher going to do on the day one of 2027, of 2028, of 2029? We don't know that answer. And that's what we need to have happen, and that's what we're missing from this government.
And actually, on that, when we look at teachers as a workforce, and we're looking at both the teachers that are currently in the profession and teachers that are being trained, what is this change going to mean for them in terms of getting into the profession?
I actually can speak personally about that. So when I trained to teach in 2006, a brand new curriculum came in 2007. I was trained under the old curriculum, and then a new curriculum came in, and then we had NCA change soon after that. It was incredibly difficult at those early stages, being trained on one thing and then having to teach another. And so it was quite difficult at the time. But the reason I did it, and the people in my sort of cohort of thing, was we had really well-supported schools, really well-resourced, well-supported schools. In the mid-2000s, education was very well looked after. We didn't have any teacher shortages. We were getting good pay rises. And we were dealing with the issues we were being faced. And we just don't have that anymore. And we've seen a consistent decline in the last 10 years in that support. And so it's actually at the feet of successive governments. And whoever comes into the next government in November needs to step up and actually make education a priority instead of just looking for sound bites.
That was Tuesday Wire host Alex speaking to President of the Post-Primary Teachers Association, Chris Abercrombie, about the replacement for NCEA.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rahina Monday. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party's Simon Court, Green Party co-leader and Auckland Central MP Chloe Swarbrick, Forrest and Bird Acting General Counsel May Downing, Honorary Academic in Physics from the University of Auckland Kevin Trenberth, and President of the Post-Primary Teachers Association Chris Abercrombie. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongoana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.